Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And this is Cousins on Crime. Coming off the heels of our missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Yes.
I have another head scratcher today. My case is an unsolved case. It is about a disappearance. So I want to talk today about the mysterious disappearance of Paula Jean Weldon. Have you ever heard of her before?
I have not.
Okay. Well, December 1st of 1946, a very beautiful 18-year-old sophomore at Bennington College, Paula Jean Weldon, had just finished up a really long day, and she decided she wanted to go for a walk. Her roommate, Elizabeth Johnson, said that they had hung out together in their room after Paula finished working a double shift at the college dining hall that day. Elizabeth recounted that after Paula had spent some time in their room studying and finishing up some homework, Paula said, "I'm all through with studies. I'm taking a long walk." I found that quote in pretty much every source that I read. So she left their room and headed out around 2:30 p.m. She was noted to be dressed in a red parka with a furry hood. She was wearing jeans. And it's said that she was wearing topsiders, but also in one report I read that she was wearing sneakers. And topsiders, to me, are like Sperry's, like kind of like a loafer type of, like a sporty loafer. And I'll get into it later why her shoes matter, but she was also wearing a wristwatch so she could keep time. It seems like she didn't really plan on being gone very long, just judging by the shoes she was wearing.
Okay.
I'm more of an indoor girl, to quote Jack from Titanic. But if I went on a really long walk, I probably wouldn't wear Sperry's.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
In December, when it was snowing. It's presumed that she was headed to the to Vermont's Long Trail, which runs along the Massachusetts-Canadian border. It's a total of 272 miles long.
Wow.
So, no, I don't think she was, like, gonna go hike the whole thing. She didn't seem like she was going to be gone that long. And she also had never been to the Long Trail. She'd always wanted to go hike there, but she'd never been. So I think it's really weird that she would just go there after finishing up her homework one day. You know what I mean? Like, it just seems like if you're going to go for a walk, you'd just walk around campus or maybe a local trail, but...
And what time of day was this, did you say?
She left around 2:30 p.m.
Okay.
But this isn't a story of someone who just walked out the door and disappeared into thin air. Paula was actually spotted by multiple people after she left her room. So, a man named Danny Fager owned a gas station that was actually across the road from the college entrance. He could see the gates of the college, like, out his window. He said he saw a girl matching Paula's description run around the side of the gravel pit, which was near the gates of the college entrance, and gives an estimate time for that to be around 2:45, which is just maybe 15 minutes after she left her room.
Okay.
I don't know why she would be running around a gravel pit. Like, he said she ran around the gravel pit and then, like, went down the side of a street or something, but she was running.
Okay.
Don't know why. Didn't get any information about if she was being chased or what. I just think he saw her running. Another man, Lewis Knapp, said that he picked up a young girl who was hitchhiking on Route 67A, which was very close to the college. He too said the girl matched Paula's description, the red coat, everything.
Okay.
And gave details about the exchange that he had with her. As she was getting into his truck, she kind of slipped, and he was like, "Be careful." And she got in, and they drove, and they didn't talk the whole way there. So he let her out on Route 9 near the Glastonbury Mountain, which was near the Long Trail, and that's where, when he picked her up, she initially said she was headed to.
Okay.
So now we have someone seeing her at 2:45 at the campus. We have a man saying he picked her up around the same time. And she wanted to go to the Long Trail. So now I'm not so sure about the gas station guy, that sighting, but the hitchhiker guy, it makes me feel like he actually did pick her up and take her because he took her there where she was intending to go. And also, it's weird because she's wearing a red parka with a furry hood, which is very, noticeable. I would think, not many people have, like, a red coat, you know?
Yeah.
So, that might be memorable to some people. And she was very beautiful. She was young. So, I feel like people would remember what she looked like. Now, when I say he dropped her off near the Long Trail, it is near it. Where he dropped her off, approximately. But he actually dropped her off 3 miles away from where she was planning to go. I don't know why. He didn't say why. I think she just told him, "You can drop me here," or whatever. And like I said, she had never been there. So, you know, like in a campground, you'll see a sign that says such and such this way, but it might be like that way, but like much further.
Right, exactly.
So I can see where maybe she got out at the wrong place or whatever. So when you think he dropped her off there, she still had 3 more miles to walk to get to that trail. So it may have taken her a little bit longer to get to the trail, but it is believed that she made it there because the last sighting of Paula was just before 4 p.m., several people spotted her in Bickford Hollow. The reports were conflicting on what the actual exchange was between Paula and this guy I'm about to tell you about. His name was Ernie Whitman. He says he talked to Paula briefly. One report said that he initiated conversation with her and said something along the lines of, "You know, that coat isn't going to cut it out here in the mountains." Like, you know, just basically in a nice way said something about the way she was dressed and how, you know, you're going to get cold out here wearing that. And then there was another report that said she initiated the conversation with him and was asking him about the trail, like how long it was and if she was going the right way. And so I don't know which is true. Maybe a little bit of both is true, but the fact remains the same. She did speak with this man before entering the trail, and that's actually the last anyone ever saw her. So that evening, snow began to fall, and it actually snowed 3 inches that night. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, when it started getting dark and Paula wasn't back yet, her roommate started to get really concerned because she's like, "Okay, now it's snowing and she's not back." She's getting kind of like concerned, but She decided not to notify anyone because she kind of felt like she might be overreacting, and she didn't want to, like, incite panic. She didn't want to make anyone, like, nervous, and she probably also didn't want her friend to get in trouble, you know? Like, if she was gone doing something all night or was with somebody, she probably didn't want to get her in trouble. So, the next morning, when Paula still wasn't back, her parents were called. Again, conflicting reports on this. Some reports say the president of the school called Paula's parents when she didn't attend classes that day. Other reports say that her roommate Elizabeth called her parents and then notified her, you know, the president of the university. Either way, her parents were notified, and they were asked, did Paula come home for the weekend? She said her parents were like, no, we've not seen her.
Okay.
So Paula's mother was so distraught that she collapsed, and they had to carry her to the bed where she stayed. I feel you. Her father was in their hometown of Stamford, Connecticut, where her family lived. That's where she was from. So when he was notified that Paula was missing, he immediately headed to Bennington, Vermont, which was where the university was. And that's actually about a 3-hour drive, just to let you know. Mr. Weldon then organized a search party, like, immediately. He worked as an engineer, so he was super organized. He was, like, hitting the ground running. He organized the search party, and it was made up of local residents in Bennington, as well as fellow students from the college, and even a local college near Bennington College called Williams College. They even got a helicopter to join the search. I don't know at what point the helicopter joined. Like, I don't know if it was that day or if it was maybe a couple days later, but nevertheless, he was not messing around.
Right.
So after a whole day searching and coming up with nothing, Mr. Weldon contacted the New York and Connecticut State Police, who ended up joining the search, which, good.
Yeah.
Vermont didn't actually have a state police department at that time. Yeah, but they did have a state investigator. His name was Almo Franzoni, and he joined the efforts and ended up raising $5,000 as reward money for any information leading to Paula's whereabouts. So after days of her being missing, some tips started trickling in. The sightings of her that I told you about, how we kind of pieced together her last movements, how she hitchhiked to the trail, apparently, supposedly.
Right.
And then a waitress in Fall River, Massachusetts, which was about 4 hours away, she said she served a woman matching Paula's description and that she seemed really agitated. So, interesting. I don't know if I believe this one. 4 hours away from the long trail, I don't know how she would have been all the way over there, meanwhile being seen by all the people at the trail. So, I don't know. Well, when Mr. Weldon heard this one, when he got this lead, he ended up taking off. And he disappeared for 36 hours. And nobody knew where he went or what he was doing until he returned. And people still don't know where he was or what he was doing. He, like, won't talk about it or wouldn't. Yeah, very bizarre. And this made people really uncomfortable because they were like, well, what if he had something to do with his daughter's disappearance? Like, where did he go? What was he doing?
And why won't he talk about
it? Yeah. And people continued to be sketched out by her dad when more information started to come out about Paula and her dad's relationship in the weeks leading up to her disappearance. Apparently, Paula was seeing someone that her dad didn't approve of.
Uh-oh.
And they were on the outs about it at the time. Paula and her dad, I mean. So Mr. Weldon ended up pointing the finger at her boyfriend as maybe being involved somehow. for no other reason than he didn't like him, and also a clairvoyant told him that her boyfriend was the perpetrator.
Oh.
So, this one was interesting. I couldn't find any information about this boyfriend. Like, literally, maybe it wasn't even serious. It was just a casual thing because he wasn't even named in any of the sources that I used.
Or maybe even not even questioned or...
Yeah, I don't know. It was just really strange. You know, it's one of those things that people jump to when someone goes missing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, did she have a boyfriend?
Right.
You know, oh, she was dating someone her dad didn't like. So naturally, that has something to do with it. But no information came about. Or nothing came of that. So by December 16th, this is a full 15 days later after she went missing, and still no credible tips leading to where Paula might be, Mr. Weldon publicly called out the police because he found out that the police had not been keeping records this whole time. All the tips that were coming in, the timeline, the search parties, like the grid of where they had searched, potential witnesses, they hadn't been keeping record of any of this.
Why? Why would you not keep records?
Exactly. Why? The only thing I can think of is that because there were so many hands in the cookie jar, so many cooks in the kitchen, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You have the New York State Police. You have the investigator from Vermont. You have the Connecticut State Police. I'm wondering if maybe each of them thought someone else was taking care of this. Because, like I said, they didn't have a Vermont State Police, so maybe New York and Connecticut felt like it wasn't their job to do that. So,
gotcha.
I'd be furious. I mean, I would be so angry because we talked about this in, you know, Sean's case. Like, when you don't start documenting things in real time, you lose the perspective. You lose that information, like the contextual information. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and now they have to go back and retroactively put this timeline together, piece this together.
Yeah.
So the media got involved in a very unique way. When they got wind of this, because like I said, Mr. Weldon was very public about, you know, maybe he did go on a little bit of a smear against the police, but the media got together and they started piecing things together. They started looking at the things that were reported. They started looking at, you know, the people that saw her, and they created and started writing things down. Something even more interesting happened because of this whole thing with the bad press about the police. It actually led to the formation of the Vermont State Police in July of 1947. So that following year. Yeah, very interesting, I thought. This whole, it's like, okay, we need somebody who's in charge of the state. Like, we need the state police. We cannot let the ball get dropped like this again.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very interesting. So the family wasn't just running into roadblocks with law enforcement and the progression of the investigation. They were literally running into roadblocks, or shall I say, trail blocks, because the weather was getting worse. There was snow, very cold temperatures, and that was really hindering the search party's ability to really canvas and search in an effective way. If you think about, and we'll talk about this later, but think about search parties and how they have to be organized and how you do grid searches and you make sure you haven't searched the same place twice and you're making sure that you're covering all the ground. Well, when everything's being covered in snow, like fresh every day, it's hard to know like what's what.
You can't mark things
in the same way that you might be able to if there was no snow on the ground. So searchers were getting really discouraged because they weren't finding anything. They weren't even finding a fluff of her furry hood. They weren't finding a hair blowing in the wind or anything, like any trace of her. And they knew that any remains of hers would probably be covered by now just because of the snowfall.
Yeah.
So the weeks turned into months and the months to years. And 9 years after Paula went missing, they finally got a break in the case that they had been waiting on for so long. A lumberjack named Fred Gaudette came forward saying he knew where Paula's body was and that he'd been in Bickford Hollow that day.
What?
He had bragged to his friends about killing Paula. He attacked her. He killed her. He buried her. And when he was interrogated, and I mean they heavily interrogated him, they got to the part where he said, you know what? I'm making this up.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he just wanted the attention.
So, did he give any details, though? Like, other than, yeah, I did it?
No. They interrogated him. I couldn't find any information as to, like, the actual interrogation, like, how long it took, what he said.
Yeah.
But basically, in a nutshell, they interrogated him, and he recanted, like, very soon after.
Jerk. That is a jerky thing to do.
I bet her family was like, finally, we're going to get some answers and, like, we're going to find what happened to her and then just get the rug ripped out from under you because somebody wants attention. I mean,
okay, but did he really do it and he realized what he was doing and then he's like, oh, never mind, I didn't do it.
I don't see why you'd do that. I feel like if you want to confess, you're going to confess. If you're not, you're not.
I don't see why you would say it that you did it if you didn't. Like,
I mean, Lena, why did Casey Anthony say she worked at Universal and then took them in there and then turned around and said, you know what? I don't work here.
Weird.
Because people are stupid. That's why. I hope he had an accident while he was out there lumberjacking. Like, I hope he accidentally chopped off a toe or something.
Oh, goodness.
Well, that wasn't the only blow her family would experience in this case. In 1968, they found skeletal remains that they initially believed could be Paula. It was in the same area she had gone missing. But forensic examination of the bones determined the victim was much older than Paula was at her disappearance. They didn't say the age, but they just said much older. So it couldn't have been her. And that's really the last thing that happened regarding her case. I mean, missing persons cases really keep me up at night because I'm like, where on this earth is that person? Like, where are they?
Yeah, there's a couple of other missing persons cases that I've gone into to try to put a story together, and I just can't make myself because I need to know.
I know. It boggles the mind.
But I do have a question. Did they, I wonder, and it probably didn't tell you anywhere, I wonder, did they find out who this body was? Who those skeletal remains belonged to?
They didn't mention.
To confirm that it wasn't her? Like, I know they say it was a much older person, but what if they got that wrong?
Yeah, I don't know. They just, it was kind of like, you know, they examined the body and it was a much older person.
They didn't have DNA testing way back when.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be... Well, but the thing is, they have nothing. Like, they have no evidence of her being anywhere. Yeah. They're just sightings. Like, I don't even know if I believe all the sightings of her that day.
Yeah.
And her roommate didn't say she was heading... Her roommate didn't say she was going to the Long Trail.
Yeah.
That was kind of pieced together when all the sightings of her going to the Long Trail, like the hitchhiking. And what I don't understand is why would she just finish studying and say, you know what, today's the day I go all the way over there to the long trail.
Right.
Like, I'm going to have to hitchhike and then get dropped off and then walk an additional 3 miles. That's not just a casual,
no.
I'm going to go for a walk and then I'll be back.
And I'm going to wear my loafers, you know, in the snow.
Right, yeah.
No.
Her case is actually still open to this day. Okay. Most people believe that she just got lost in the woods and died.
No.
Yeah, due to exposure of the elements. But where's her body?
Yeah.
Where's the red coat?
She would not have gone way off the trail.
The red coat, too. It's like, that's hard to miss. Even in snow, I feel like at some point when this trail is very popular, by the way. So it's probably heavily trafficked at certain times of the year. When spring melted the snow, why wasn't even her coat found? Why wasn't a shoe found? Why wasn't anything found? Nothing.
Well, what if this woman that was seen in Massachusetts wearing a red coat, what if she had something to do with it and stole her coat? I mean,
no, that's a good point. Like, what if someone did take her coat? I mean,
and then she's agitated because, I don't know, I'm making this all up in my head, but.
Well, and some people actually think she ran away with a guy or even left by herself to complete suicide, which I think is just such a lazy theory. I hate when people are like, oh, she just ran off. Yeah. She probably ran off and completed suicide. That's probably what happened.
Yeah.
Like, come on. There's no evidence to suggest that she ran away with a guy. And like I said, I couldn't even find any information about the supposed boyfriend that she had that her dad didn't like. So, why would she hitchhike? You know what I mean? Like, why would she hitchhike to a trail and then run away on the trail?
I feel like the hitchhiker needed to be, like, interrogated. Yeah. Because in most cases like this, it's usually the hitchhiker.
Yeah, but then, like, also, people saw her entering the trail. Like, people said, like, that guy said he talked to her while she was there, and
true,
you know, that was around 4, and, you know, like, that kind of adds up with how long does it take you to walk 3 miles? If she leaves at 2:45, she's picked up at 2:45, she's dropped off, then walks 3 miles, and she's seen just before 4 o'clock at the trail. That adds up. But then she's never seen again. There were reports that she was depressed in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, but I've said it before and I'll say it again. Not all depressed people go off and complete suicide, and most depressed people don't want to do that. They don't want it in their life. I mean, by all accounts, she was a very diligent student, and she was a typical adolescent young lady. So just quit, like, with the whole depression and, like, suicide stuff. Like, I just don't believe any of that. And again, where's her body? If she went off and did that, I feel like, why hasn't she been found? And, you know, I don't necessarily think she succumbed to the elements either. Actually, because I read she was very outdoorsy, very opposite than of myself. She loved hiking. She loved camping. And she seemed to be very experienced when it came to being outdoors. So I would, you know, we talked about in the last episode where it could definitely happen where people who are experienced campers or hikers, you know, make one wrong move and, like, it happens.
Yeah.
But she had nothing with her. She didn't take anything with her in order to, like, go camp out or
to be gone. She wasn't gonna
go hiking anywhere. She literally just wanted to go for a walk. Again, I don't know why she went all the way to the long trail to do that walk. Maybe she just got a wild hair and was like, you know, I'm just going to go over there. Like, what's the harm? I'll be back.
I mean, I've done things like that. I like to be spontaneous, mm-hmm. but...
Me too. I've done that before, so I can totally relate. And she was 18, so, you know, when you're 18, you're kind of fearless. You just...
True.
You just don't have a concept of, like, boundaries like maybe you do...
Yeah, it's not going to happen in your late 30s. I'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if she did in fact hitchhike, then she probably felt safe in her community. So I don't know that I think the lost in the woods, the whole died because of exposure thing.
Yeah.
That, I don't know. Like, I just don't know about that theory.
I agree with you.
Also, the Long Trail has clear markings, and I was looking on their website, and apparently they've, since it was formed, they've always had these big black squares that have trail markings on the trees. Okay. So, for her to stray off of the trail, like... I don't know that she would have done that in the attire she was wearing. I find it hard to believe she would have strayed from that footpath, you know?
Yeah.
I think someone took her. I just think someone took her because, I mean, she was alone. She was obviously unfamiliar with the area. I even wonder about this Ernie Whitman guy who saw her entering the trail and said that he spoke with her. I wonder about him because, you know, he says, oh yeah, I talked to her and she asked me about the trail, or yeah, I talked to her and I said, you're not dressed for the elements out here or whatever. Because there were conflicting reports about what he said, I'm wondering if he said different things to different people about what they talked about, you know?
Yeah. And he was expressing concern for her, like acting like he's concerned.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that gross when killers do that? And when people who have abducted people, they're like, yeah, I offered them a ride or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, there was that information about the fact that she was asking him where the entrance to the trail was and how long it was. So maybe he picked up on the fact that she wasn't familiar with the area and thought maybe he's like, oh yeah, I'll walk you over there or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm looking at him as being suspicious.
Or maybe she walked a little bit into the trail, decided she was done, and then found another, you know, hitchhiked, you know, found another car to get in, and that's who took her, you know?
Yeah, it's so 100 things could have happened to her.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when you start thinking about her movements and things, there are so many different theories out there, but, you know, in the interest of... spooky season, Lena. I mean, it's September, and as far as I'm concerned, it might as well be October. I've already had 2 pumpkin spice lattes, and I'm high on life. So, with that, I want to tell you about one other theory that comes up in Paula's case, and that's the Bennington Triangle.
Uh-oh.
I'm holding a triangle above my head.
Awkward.
I wish you could all see Lena. She's like,
What's going on?
So now I want to tell you about the Bennington Triangle. You've heard about the Bermuda Triangle, right? That's pretty famous as far as weird. Well, the Bennington Triangle is in the southwest portion of Vermont, and it's also believed to have otherworldly implications. So the Bennington Triangle is a stretch of woodlands that includes Bennington, Woodford, Shaftesbury, or as Daniel would say, Shaftesbury, and 2 little ghost towns, Somerset and Glastonbury. Or Glastonbury. Yeah, lots of berries. It was always a very mysterious area with disappearances and even a Bigfoot-type creature that had been seen in the area. But it wasn't always called Bennington Triangle. That name was actually coined by author Joseph Citro. He compared the area to the Bridgewater Triangle, which is actually located in Massachusetts near there. So there, too, had also happened like a lot of weird, unexplained things believed to maybe be paranormal. While there have been dozens of reported disappearances in the Bennington Triangle around the time Paula Jean Weldon disappeared, between 1945 and 1950, four other people vanished off the face of the earth. They were 8-year-old Paul Jepson, 53-year-old Frida Langer, 74-year-old Middle Rivers, and James Tedrod, who was 68. Mm-hmm. And actually, I say they all vanished. Only one of those five people, so the four and then Paula Jean, only one was ever found, and that was Frida Langer. Her body was found. That's something strange about her. Was her body was found in an area that had already been searched multiple times before. Oh, I sometimes strange. Hear this in cases.
Yeah.
When a body is found in the place where people are like, we searched there like multiple times and there was nothing. Yeah. It's really unsettling. It's really odd.
Yeah.
So there is some Native American lore regarding this area. The Abenaki tribe, they're an indigenous group of people that were a part of the Algonquin Nation. I hope I'm saying that correctly, of Native Americans. Interestingly, this was the first group of Native Americans that the English encountered when they stole their land. I mean, discovered America.
Let me rephrase that.
Sadly, I couldn't find any information as to like when the tribe was actually established, but I mean, they were at least there in the early 1600s when the English settled in America.
Yes.
So the Abenaki, I hope I'm saying that correctly, made the Glastonbury Mountains their home. This was before the English came, by the way. They believed their god lived at the peak of the mountain, and they claimed that the four winds met at that peak, which would cause the winds and the weather to change erratically and on a dime. Wow. So they believed that cursed the mountain and the area. In fact, they said the mountain would open up and swallow anyone who came upon a particular stone. They called it the man-eating stone. So if you happen upon this particular stone and you stepped on it, the ground would open and just swallow you in there.
Oh, wow.
So that was what they believed. Okay. Hundreds of years later, in the 1800s, the town of Glastonbury was actually thriving with industry. I mentioned it was a ghost town, but in the 1800s, it was a pretty lively town. It only had 241 residents, but they did have a railroad. They had a school, a post office. There were homes there. It was like a legit little town. And like I said, they had a railroad, so there was a lot of industry coming through there.
Okay.
So they were doing pretty good. In 1892, Henry McDowell murdered his coworker. He ended up bludgeoning him to death because he said that he heard voices telling him to do it.
Oh.
They, of course, sent him to a psych ward. Mm. But he escaped, and he was never seen again. So, good. Maybe he hopped on that railroad and rode it till he couldn't ride anymore. In 1897, John Harbor was shot and killed by an unknown person. Maybe it was Henry McDowell. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But the murder was never solved. He was actually found with the weapon, like, near him, But nobody was around, and they, I guess, were like, this is a real whodunit.
Yeah.
Dunno. Well, then in 1898, just the following year, Glastonbury finally met its demise when a flood ripped through the town and destroyed everything. Destroyed homes. It even destroyed the railroad. So that's when everything just fell apart, and they believe that that area is cursed because it totally wiped out that town. Gotcha. You know, that town that was at the peak of its life, I guess you could say. So now historians look at all of this and they say, of course, like, this is all just silliness. Like, the Native American beliefs, the, you know, the curses, like, stop with the silliness. One such historian and author, his name was Tyler Resch, I hope I'm saying that correctly, says he's skeptical of all this paranormal nonsense. He's like, honey, that wasn't a man-eating stone that swallowed someone up. It's called a sinkhole. Let me tell you about it. So, I mean, yeah. And he also said he's really surprised there haven't been more disappearances than those that have been reported. And truthfully, there probably are tons more people that have disappeared out there. You know, like when you hear about John and Jane Doe's that are being found, and like sometimes they're never identified, and you're like, how is no one looking for you?
Yeah.
But, you know, it happens, so.
Yeah.
Tyler Resch also says that even though there are about 40 reported disappearances inside the Bennington Triangle, Middle Rivers, I talked about him earlier that he disappeared. He was actually the only one that was in the Bennington Triangle when he disappeared. So the other disappearances that were very near there, they were near but outside the triangle.
Okay.
So he says that proves that the Bennington Triangle is not responsible for all these disappearances. It's just wilderness. It's just a vast land, and people just go missing. So the Bennington Triangle seems to not be a great explanation for what might have happened to Paula Jean Weldon. So what happened to her?
Yeah.
Like, what happened to her? Where is she?
If anybody knows.
If anybody knows, please let me know.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight.
I mean, because that was, you said, in the 40s, so.
Yeah.
Maybe there's still somebody alive that knows.
You know, we've talked about this in the Blue Mound Massacre case. It's like, secrets, I feel like, trickle through the generations.
Yes, yeah.
Dirty little secrets. They make their way down, down, down. It's like, be sure your sins will find you out.
Yeah, that's so true.
And I think someone must have confessed. Someone must have said something. Someone must have overheard something, you know, with these cases. And I'm like, who's out there carrying that information around still?
Right. Yeah. Wouldn't that be amazing if somebody...
Isn't it wild?
Yeah. If somebody...
I mean, I found a lot of sources on this case. And every single source pretty much has the same information that I gave you, which I feel like is really not a lot to go on. But all of the sources point to the Bennington Triangle and the, you know, the paranormal. Like, maybe she was one of the people that fell into the earth and just disappeared in a weird way. And I'm just, I don't know, I'm one of those very realistic thinkers. Like,
yeah,
when you think about the Bermuda Triangle, I think things have been proven about the Bermuda Triangle, about, like, magnetic forces and those things.
Yeah.
not paranormal things, like, you know what I mean? Like wind pressures and things that make planes just fall out of the sky.
Yeah.
Like scientific explanations. But, and you can't fault the Native Americans for thinking that the earth was swallowing someone up because they didn't know what sinkholes were back then. You know what I mean? Like, well, they see someone just fall through the earth and they're like,
but Native Americans are very spiritual people, so
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, definitely beliefs. Part of their culture. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I thought that was very interesting to kind of lead us in to spooky season.
Okay, sorry.
You know, our fifth great-grandfather was a very well-to-do. Was he a chief?
I think he was a chief. Well, he's not wearing, like, a chief headset. I mean, headset. Headdress.
Yeah, he lived from 1780 to 1849. And our moms have been doing some ancestral digging, and they found this amazing picture of him, and he's just like standing on the mountain being all sorts of cool with his loincloth blowing in the breeze
and his moccasins. I love his shoes.
Oh my gosh, me too. Where can I get some of those?
I absolutely love this picture, and he's holding a spear.
Yeah,
like,
guys, this is legit. Is that a snake underneath him?
Yeah, well, I think it's either a snake or snake skin, but
ew.
I mean, this is...
He wasn't scared.
Legit. No.
His name was Jesse Halfbreed.
I wish I knew him.
I know.
I've always, like I said, I think I said this in the last episode, I've always been interested in the Native American culture. Yeah. I mean, I've always known that I've had Native American ancestors, mm-hmm. But this picture is just... does something
to me. I know.
We're going to Oklahoma this weekend. Well, there's a Native American powwow that's open to the public. And I'm gonna
what? Go. That's so cool.
It's on Saturday.
Oh, no.
I know. Well, I think it goes into Sunday. So maybe you'll be able to make it. But
man. What are you going to do there?
I'm going to watch the dances, man.
Try and get some moves for me. Maybe you can teach me on the side. A little crank it up jalopy.
I want to know if anybody else has ever done that chair. Crank it up jalopy. Can you please write in and tell us?
Maybe if you guys are good, like if you be good. Maybe we'll do the chair and post it on Instagram. I don't know. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't.
What are you getting into?
We're going to be together. So we probably should flood our Instagram with togetherness. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Cousins on cheers. Cousins on Mexican food. Cousins on the reservation. Cousins on crime. Paula Jean, where are you, honey? Where are you, sweetie?
We'll find you.
Where'd you go?
I'm gonna go hiking. I'm gonna go find her.
I'm so sorry that you haven't been laid to rest, but I hope wherever you are at peace.
Yes.
Well, this was great. We should do it again sometime.
Yeah, let's.
You wanna do it again?
Let's do it.
Next week?
Yeah.
All right. All right, see you later, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.